Welcome to Imperium Cast 19. Sorry, I gotta retake that. I never really fucking know what to say. Welcome to Imperium Cast 19. This time it is just Joel and myself here. We haven't done this in a little while. I think it was the number 10 was the last one that we kind of flew solo, the two of us. So it's kind of back to basics, I guess. But we were going to do a bit of an in-depth book review here, which I think will be kind of interesting. But before we get to that, I just want to mention that Imperium Press, we have recently, in the last month or so, we've released the Sorrell book, Reflections on Violence. If you go to imperiumpress.org, have a look at that. It's an excellent text. I did a bit of an in-depth discussion on countercurrents recently on that. And I think it's something that's it's absolutely useful to us today. Very interesting thinker, Sorrell. He's sort of a third position precursor to fascism, actually, coming from the left of all places. So check that out. We've also got the Gumroad. If you go to imperiumpress.gumroad.com, you'll be able to access hardcovers. You'll be able to check out the other podcast and lots of other goodies and everything like that. So have a look at that. Signing up to the Gumroad really actually helps us a lot because it means that we don't really have to care as much about what PayPal and credit card processors think. It just keeps us kind of independent. So that's very helpful. But yeah, today, so we are reading and critiquing and summarizing a book called Critique and Crisis by Reinhard Koselleck. It's a book that was written in the 1960s by an ex-National Socialist. And it's a pretty interesting book, actually. Basically, the fundamental question that it answers is, where did the Enlightenment come from? Why does everything seem to be so fucked right now? Why is it just sort of like, why do we live in a world of like runaway critique? This is the crisis aspect of it. So with that, I'll hand it over to Joel. And Joel, maybe you can give us a rundown of the text.
Yeah, so this is a work of conceptual history. So basically what he's doing in the text is he's kind of walking us through a kind of historical narrative, but the historical narrative isn't very focused upon the development of real-world events too much. It's far more focused upon the development of ideas, the development of concepts. And so he focuses kind of on intellectual history, but also the kind of social and political context within which that intellectual history unfolds. And he kind of gives us a narrative. Now, you could say that that is a weakness of the text because, you know, history doesn't just simply move through the production of intellectuals. It moves through many other, far more material, organizational modalities. But there's lots of other history like that that you can read. So rather than reading this as an exhaustive account, I think you should read it as a supplemental account, if anything. But yeah, to give the kind of basic rundown of the narrative, he goes back to, well, absolutism. And the context out of which absolutism emerges, 16th century, 17th century Europe. And he particularly focuses initially on the work of Hobbes as probably like the great, most preeminent absolutist, but also like in terms of political theory, but also the kind of grandfather of liberalism in many ways. An absolute giant, whatever you think of him, of political philosophy, one of the absolute household names, Thomas Hobbes. And he describes how Hobbes, basically what Hobbes's fundamental concern is that he just saw his country ripped apart in civil war. And that civil war was kind of demarcated upon religious denominational lines. You know, you had the Catholics, you had the Protestants, etc. And this deeply troubled Hobbes, you know, in all of his writings, you can see that he sincerely was freaked out, basically, and just saddened by the tragedy of civil war. He did not want to see his own people killing each other. And so the solution that he presents in a nutshell is absolutism, that if, well, we all basically have to, you know, we can have our private conscience over here where we have our particular kind of beliefs about Christianity, and that's all well and good. But in the public square, in the kind of political, the kind of political paradigm, we have to kind of check all that at the door and just submit to the authority of the king for the sake of peace and order so that we can live, you know, essentially, you know, in peace, you know, with our fellow Englishmen. So kind of what the critique of Kosellek is of this is that basically what Hobbes is doing is he's creating a dualism. On the one hand, you have politics. On the other hand, you have morality. So morality becomes relegated to the private sphere and politics becomes a public affair. And sovereignty therefore becomes immoral or amoral, I should probably say. Its concern is not good and evil, but peace. The preeminent evil in a way is war. And yeah, therefore all the king's responsibility or the prince's responsibility is to maintain sovereignty and therefore peace. But he has created this private realm, and basically the kind of Hobbesian analysis, it has this kind of atomic individualism. So we just have these private individual consciences that all have their like particular views on Christianity and their private moralities. And then you have the public square, which is personified by the state and sovereignty itself. And he kind of progresses from here to discuss Locke. And in Locke, you have a development of this idea beyond this dichotomy of the individual and the state. Locke basically creates a kind of third category, civil society. You know, Locke says, okay, well, we have, you know, the state's laws, like the civil law, we have the divine law, the law of the church, then we have something called philosophical law, and divine law ultimately is, you know, enforced in the afterlife, and civil law is enforced by the state, but philosophical law is enforced socially. It's kind of like, obviously he didn't use the term back then, but you could use the term soft power in a way to describe it. It's, you know, socially reinforced through not through violence or the courts, but through prestige and ostracism and, you know, these kinds of subtle social accolades or that kind of condition people into forming a kind of consensus in, you know, cultural and moral understanding. And so this kind of problematizes the dichotomy of Hobbes, because Hobbes, you know, obviously his concern is we've got to kind of keep the religious debate out of politics so that we can live in peace. Otherwise it'll turn us against each other. We have to be united as one people despite these religious differences. But by noticing, you know, by Locke noticing the philosophical law and noticing that civil society is a thing, this presents a new challenge, because, you know, Hobbes uses reason to kind of keep religion at arm's length for the sake of peace. But then reason still poses the same problem, because if we have civil society, then kind of debate over morality presents the same problem that debate over religion once did from a sociological or political standpoint. And so Kosellek develops from here to discuss, well, Freemasonry and the Illuminati, like the Bavarian Illuminati and you know, like the like kind of like lodge culture, where, you know, the absolute state forms dominates the public realm, but the private realm becomes elevated out of pure individual experiences within one's own mind to, you know, the lodge. The lodge is a place which has secrecy. You know, what happens in the lodge stays in the lodge. No one kind of reports on what you said to the state. And so you're kind of outside of the state supervision where you can engage in philosophical discussion and exploration. And so the lodge system enables a kind of bourgeois civil society to form where philosophical debate can take place in a state of liberty. And this is the basis from which morality, as distinguished from politics in this kind of absolutist compromise, comes to take on a kind of social intensification. And then Kaselic describes how, you know, particularly with the Bavarian Illuminati, then you start to get the kind of politicization of the lodge. It starts to get ideas about trying to infiltrate the state and impose this new enlightened morality that has been developed within the lodge, you know, upon the state through infiltrating the state and the so-called Republic of Letters, where you have these Enlightenment philosophers all, you know, creating kind of secularized, you know, philosophy, you know, to engage in kind of moral debate and political debate. And this ultimately sets the groundwork for the complete delegitimization of the absolutist state. People have kind of forgotten the old religious wars. Now no one is so much concerned about that. Now the concern is far more upon the morality of the state. And because the state was explicitly founded as an amoral institution, as a kind of a non-decision upon morality, a kind of privatization of morality, you know, the state can't really, in its absolutist form, can't really justify itself within this new discourse of enlightened civil society. You know, some states try to engage in this kind of reformist, enlightened absolutism with mixed results. Maybe it works out a little bit better for the Germans than the French, but it doesn't really take anywhere. And ultimately civil society, because, you know, we had this private-public distinction, which was originally the kind of private conscience of the individual and the state, this morphs into a kind of society-state distinction and this sense that the state has no legitimacy unless that legitimacy is granted by society. So this naturally tends to him discussing at the end of the book Rousseau's theories and this kind of permanent state of revolution where civil society has to kind of engage in this perpetual critique. The state is in a constant state of a crisis of legitimacy. And civil society is put in kind of perpetual critique of the state, but every time it captures the state, it kind of engages in a form of hypocrisy because it, when engaging in pure critique, you have a kind of pure moral vantage point of exteriority. But then as soon as you then capture the state and responsibility comes on your shoulders, you know, then you end up, you know, essentially violating your own critique. We could see this, you know, he doesn't really discuss communism in the text, but we could see this maybe most particularly in the experience of, say, the Soviet Union, where, you know, Marxism obviously kind of comes out of Hegelianism, actually as a little kind of, a little bit of a touch on Hegelianism. Kaselic has an interesting point to make about philosophy of history, and this will cycle back to the what I was going to say about communism. How philosophy of history is this kind of convenient way for this enlightened civil society to kind of plan, morally plan revolution under the pretext of just kind of disinterestedly studying history. That, oh, we are progressives insofar as we rationally accept the trajectory of history, but history is going to go in this particular direction as our philosophy of history says it will, according to this kind of dialectical logic or whatever. But no, you're actually imposing a value set upon history. You're planning history as this kind of unfolding of this moral discourse, but then kind of standing back and not taking responsibility for it. And this ultimately mutates into Marxism, obviously, and the whole purpose of Marxism. There's a kind of there's a shared utopianism between Marxism and some of these earlier Freemasonic and you know, other kind of related utopian projects of the Enlightenment, of, you know, the whittling away of the state and the kind of impact, like kind of the emancipation through reason of the individual and of the society ultimately. And, you know, then you have obviously the revolution, and it doesn't take too long before you have, you know, gulags with millions of people in them. I mean, people talk about the French Revolution and the terror, the reign of terror that emerged after that. But I mean, that really pales in comparison to the brutality, obviously, of the Soviet Union. So, you know, that there is this hypocrisy that kind of ends up kind of fundamentally occurring, where this perpetual revolution cycles back upon itself as it succeeds, and just kind of sucks itself into its own crisis of legitimacy that it created in the absolutist state, where previously, before absolutism, the state's legitimacy wasn't granted directly by society, but by way of sacred tradition, fundamentally from God and natural law. As soon as you become unplugged from this system, and you have this permanent state of revolution, you know, things get a lot messier. So yeah, it's I think it's a very compelling, you know, kind of narrative that he weaves, you know, particularly in his discussion, I think which is often overlooked, of groups like the Freemasons, and that kind of production of this bourgeois civil society in the secrecy and mystery of the lodge, as this context within it can kind of like organically form, as opposed to you know, something inherent to the Freemasonic religion that produces these particular political outcomes. It's almost as though the kind of religious beliefs of the Freemasons are kind of secondary to this kind of political and ethical function that they're performing. So anyway, I'll pass it over to Mike to get your thoughts.
Yeah, well, it is an interesting book. And I think ultimately it's a book that it can be useful to us, but in a kind of roundabout way. It's really kind of preceded by its reputation for being reactionary. I mean, it's not, you know, famous the way that, like, you know, Being in Time is, or Das Kapital or anything like that. But, you know, looking into it here, apparently Kosalek is actually quite, quite well regarded as a historian, one of the more important historians of the 20th century. But the book definitely has a reputation for being reactionary. And in the context in which it was written, I believe it's the 1960s, it was perceived as being too cynical toward the Enlightenment, accusing the birth of modernity essentially as being hypocritical. This was something pretty radical for its time. The book itself, actually, I actually found it very tough going. It took me a long time to get through it. It's only 200 pages or so. But the style is, it's very repetitive. I really think that this thesis could have been laid out in about 40 pages. but in any case, I mean, like, the content of the ideas is something that actually does need to be grappled with. So the basic idea of the thesis, to condense what you said there, Joel, is that the separation of the moral and the political spheres that happened in the absolutist age effectively caused the Enlightenment and caused their corollaries of terror and ultimately in the 20th century totalitarianism, which is actually, I think that this thesis is generally right. The problem is that the creation of this schism between morality and politics predates absolutism by a very, very long way, actually. And in fact, absolutism was originally a response to the results of that schism of morality and politics that already existed. I mean, this was the cause of the wars of religion that absolutism was essentially a solution to. This is basically what it was intended to solve. This is effectively what Hobbes's Leviathan is all about. So I think that it seems to me that the historical starting point that Kosellek chooses is actually arbitrary. And in fact, it's much too late, I would say. He even states outright at the beginning of the book that for the purposes of this thesis of the separation of morality and politics, he's only going to consider the events from absolutism onward. And I mean, he does throughout the text, he does allude to earlier historical epochs from time to time. You know, he talks at times about the Renaissance and other earlier times, and about the wars of religion itself. But he sort of, for some reason, he refuses to trace the roots of this schism back any further. And this is really strange, because clearly there was a split. I mean, that's the whole point of absolutism, is to overcome this split that effectively was causing civil war. It's very strange, and I can sort of illustrate that by an analogy. Like, I kept thinking to myself as I'm reading this book, it's like, imagine that there's a murder trial, and the court's trying to figure out, like, why this guy's been killed or something like that. And then, you know, suppose the defense calls in this expert witness, and this is Kosellek. And he gives his testimony, and it's really detailed, and the reasoning and the evidence behind it is actually quite convincing. And he shows that, you know, the victim died of denial of oxygen to the brain or whatever, and then he shows that this denial of oxygen was caused by, like, extreme low blood pressure, and the low blood pressure was caused by profuse bleeding, and then he shows that the bleeding was caused by a bullet wound. But he refuses to conclude that the victim was shot. Why? Because, you know, for the purposes of the thesis, he's only going to consider events from the bullet wound onward, right? So, like, saying that crisis, the thesis being that crisis is caused by critique, which grew out of absolutism, and we're going to restrict our analysis to that, is, you know, it's leaving out the fact that the guy was shot, right? Like, there's more to the story than that. So I don't think, you know, no one would obviously accept this expert analysis in a court of law. So it seems to me that there's something wrong with the analysis here. Now, as far as it goes, actually, I think it's true that this schism did cause the crisis that he identifies. It's just that the roots of it lie earlier. And because of this, that this thesis of the schism between morality and politics can apply to earlier epochs. They can apply to earlier episodes in European history. And as a result, the Kosellek's thesis ends up being way more reactionary than it seems even at first. So you could write the same book, basically, about the Reformation, for example, which was itself a similar crisis brought on by a similar schism. You could write the same history about the early Christian church, which, again, was brought on by a schism between public... effectively public law and private morality by the introduction of conscience. So it's a very interesting book, and I think that we can get a lot out of it, but it sort of does more than it actually than it actually states in the book itself, because it can be applied transhistorically, which is quite interesting, because it's a work of conceptual history, and the idea being that the history of ideas is particular to a particular time or whatever. So anyway, that's sort of my overall take on the book itself. So I'll just get your thoughts on that, Joel.
Yeah, well, I'm interested to read more of his work because I believe this was earlier on in his career, and a lot of his work actually isn't translated, I believe, into English from German, because obviously he wrote all these texts originally in German. Maybe that could be an interesting project for Imperium Press to look into at some point. But, you know, I think, yeah, as I kind of alluded to in my initial comments, I think there are kind of major flaws just with engaging in just a purely, you know, history of ideas, intellectual history approach to the unfolding of history. I think, you know, it's a completely different pace and trajectory than, you know, some of these like structural accounts of history that, you know, I've discussed many times before on YouTube and other places, like particularly like if I think of something that's totally different than this would be like Theda Scotch-Pole's account of the French Revolution relative to this, for example, which focuses far more upon like just the brass tacks of political economy and you know, how different class interests are able to kind of organize and get resources and exploit structural weaknesses in like, you know, the state and these kinds of things. And I think there's a lot of validity to those kinds of analyses, but I think also it's important to kind of not retroject back upon history this kind of cynical view that like everyone is just out for, you know, cynical gain, and that there's no kind of moral compulsion that's driving any of this behavior, because, you know, I just don't think that's true. I think it's always a mixture of the two. Like I was just doing a live stream recently on my YouTube channel talking about so-called neoliberal international relations theorists, and I was watching some interviews, an interview of you know, a few of these theorists, and they were talking about their fundamental motivations, and it seemed like when they said, well, you know, I want to try and advance a theory that privileges cooperation over conflict because, you know, I want less wars in the world and I want a more peaceful world without the destruction of war. It's like, yeah, this guy probably actually does believe that. Why wouldn't he? And I think, you know, a lot of elite crusades or kind of elite drives in policy making and in revolutionary action obviously are kind of founded in these kind of morally compelling narratives. And when we kind of look back upon, you know, like the 16th or the 17th or the 18th centuries from today, we kind of presume that they had access to, we just naturally presume that everyone always had access to a lot of the same kind of conceptual materials that we have available to us when thinking about the world today. But without this kind of progression of ideas, it's just not possible to think like someone does in the 21st century, you know, in the 18th century. So this kind of work was interesting as a way of trying to put yourself back in the kind of milieu of the ideas that were kind of innovative back then, and kind of like thinking through from like each phase shift as the ideas progressed. So I think it's a kind of useful exercise insofar as it's doing that. But when it comes to analyzing fundamentally what liberalism is, I don't think it was ultimately super satisfying because, you know, even if you look at this idea of permanent revolution, it's like, well, there's lots of different ways to interpret this, you know, like the 20th century proposed, you know, three fundamental genres of how to interpret the notion of perpetual revolution. And in the kind of like dialectical progression of ideas through history or whatever, all three of those are correct answers in a sense, you know, because they all kind of like flow from anteceding kind of intellectual currents. And that what was decisive between them wasn't, you know, who won, you know, in the battle of ideas. It was, you know, who won wars. So, you know, that I think that that's something that needs to be taken into consideration into these accounts where
where people kind of overemphasize conceptual developments and say, well, you know, if people didn't think this, then they wouldn't have thought this and this, 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 and this, and this, and therefore this, which is what's wrong today. And it's like, well, through that whole process of all these different phase shifts and what people think, there was a whole bunch of conflict, a whole bunch of people with different ideas vying for power against them. And it wasn't as though everyone, you know, when society, quote unquote, decides to like start believing new stuff, that everyone just agrees. The formation of consensus and the kind of institutionalization of consensus and enforcement of consensus is a very complex thing. So, I think that's very important. I think you got, you know, in other words, you really have to kind of model, you have to have some kind of materialist model of power that's mixed into your analysis, but you'd also, I don't think you don't want to overdose on that either. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that kind of dichotomy between, you could say, like structure and agency, or ideas and material conditions, or, you know, however you want to frame it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're right. Kosalek he's concentrating on one side of the ledger. And he's basically concentrating almost 100% on the notion that ideas drive material conditions, or that ideas drive history. I do have some sympathy with that to a degree, but it is a weakness in the text, because the contention that law, that is, you know, we're talking between the schism of morality and politics, the contention that law or politics has to conform to popular morality. I think this idea might have had some currency in the 60s when the book was written, but the subsequent history, especially very recent history, puts the lie to that. The law or politics has to conform to elite morality. What could you have called the bourgeoisie, the elite in the society of the absolutist Europe? Not clearly, anyway. You know, Locke is supposedly, like, he's said to speak for the bourgeois, but he wasn't one of them. I don't believe. I think he was, you know, the son of a lawyer or something like that. So someone who was involved in the state apparatus at some stage. And, you know, he says in the text that when this kind of like civic morality becomes that sort of naturally or spontaneously, this like civic morality becomes a public power, it has political effects, but it only works intellectually, and it forces every other citizen to adapt himself not to the vicissitudes and realities of politics, but principally to the law of public opinion, right? And I mean, does this ring true today? It doesn't with me. It looks ridiculously naive to me today, right? So I think that if the thesis is to be taken seriously, that absolutism opened the way for the bourgeoisie, it's only insofar as it enabled the peace and prosperity that gave rise to it, not by some sort of like moral error or whatever. But what you have, sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, but I was going to say, I do think, though, don't you think there is something to what he's saying, particularly when talking about Hobbes, in this, you know, that in the context of, you know, religious civil wars, and this wasn't just an English experience, obviously, they had similar experiences across Europe, that there was a kind of bracketing of the political from a lot of like moral debate, because of just simply how destructive it came to be seen as to social and political stability. Like, don't you think that there is something to that, and that by kind of like sending that element underground allowing it to fester essentially in these secret societies or whatever, that did ultimately kind of produce, I think there is something to that thesis, don't you think, that did ultimately produce like conditions under which a kind of you know, a kind of reaction would eventually emerge from that, which ended up being the basis for a lot of like liberal revolutionary actions that kind of came like a century or so later.
Yeah, actually, I definitely agree that this schism that he's talking about did sort of lead to the crisis that he thinks it led to. But the thing that like I think is a little strange about the book is that it sort of seems to imply, sometimes implicitly and sometimes even outright states explicitly, that this was something unique to the modern world. I think you could take this whole book and, abstracting away the particulars, you could write the same book about the Reformation or other earlier episodes in European history, and it would not, effectively, it would not change. Like, you know, when he says that the, you know, the extension of the boundary between the internal and external spheres of influence, you know, between morality and politics, it had all these unexpected consequences, because, you know, although criticism like reaches into politics, it doesn't actually, you know, renounce its unpolitical character, you know, that its claims to assure the truth, you know, of reason and like natural law and making moral claims. I think all of this could have been said about the early church fathers, or it could have been said about Luther and Calvin, and even the stuff about the secret societies, you know, with the Masons and the Illuminati and everything like that. It fits hip and thigh onto the early Christian or Protestant communities. And the stuff that he says about the philosophy of history is also analogous as well, because of course these were movements that retconned history effectively, at least the history that was known in their society. So it's actually, I think it's a very dangerous book, and it's dangerous even for some of the people who think that they can kind of use it, right? Like he's been, Kosolek has been criticized for trying to justify the pre-Enlightenment world. But if he's doing that, he's very shrewd to limit the thesis to absolutism and beyond. If he extended it back any further, it would erode a lot of the pre-Enlightenment past as well. So I think that what he's doing, like the thesis is correct. It's just that it applies much more broadly than it's being applied here. But there's also an interesting aspect to it, where what we have today is kind of like an inverted version of what he's describing. It's kind of the opposite dynamic that he describes in the Enlightenment. So instead of politics now being subjected to a moral verdict, and this moral verdict, you know, by civil society that Locke is pointing out, turning into a political factor, we actually have morality being shaped by politics, right? It's almost like, you know, the new state, the new totalitarianism, or you could say even the new absolutism, has learned and is not going to make the same mistake again, right? Like it's going to crack down on the, you know, analogous bourgeois of today before it gets too uppity. Like the new state has kind of adapted this crisis of the schism between morality and politics to its own goals. And of course, today that's total social reconstruction. So instead of the moralization of politics, which is kind of like brought on a civil war, you know, it brings on this crisis that Kosolek points out. Now we have the politicization of morality, and this is a new crisis. And this crisis it calls for its own absolutism, its own, you know, tyrannical, for lack of a better term, government response. And so, like, you know, just as the crisis that conscience brought on in the wars of religion and from absolutism forward called for political absolutism in its time, now we have a new call for political absolutism, but politics is essentially overcoming morality. And this is the situation that we find ourselves in. So it seems like the inevitability that the thesis sort of paints, like that, you know, as long as people basically disagree, as long as enough people in polite society disagree with, you know, totalitarianism, basically, totalitarianism is destined to fall. Well, I hope he's right. But right now, we're in a very different place.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you can kind of see what we have right now as I mean, I guess you could call it a kind of totalitarianism, but I think it's more an expression of that kind of hypocritical, you know, hypocritical revolution, that perpetual state of crisis that can't solve itself without going deeper and deeper into hypocrisy. Because, you know, there is a deep paradox with Western states today, where on the one hand, you can kind of create a narrative about them that they're kind of more interventionist and more totalitarian than ever before. But then on the other hand, there is this kind of emancipatory project that is so intense that they're pursuing. And I think this goes some way, like just seeing these trends point out in this book, it goes some way to kind of describing, you know, how you could get that kind of arrangement, where you have like libertarians looking at this and saying, this is communism. And then you have communists looking at this and saying, well, this is like neoliberal capitalism or whatever, right? Imperialism or whatever they call it. And like, yeah, how you can have all these different political ideologies that look at this and view it as all different things, because it is this kind of like Franken monster of all these different schizophrenic positions, built upon a kind of complex set of contradictions. It doesn't have one fundamental coherent logic. And I think it's just because it's this perpetual exacerbation of this crisis, which Kaselek is noticing. So to be fair to Kaselek, I think he does get something quite profound. You know, he hits something quite profound in this text. But also, I think when it comes to civil society, I mean, I'm not saying that the Freemasons of the late 18th century or whatever were bastions of morality and virtue or anything, but, you know, I think it is a little bit night and day from then to now. I think it seems like, looking back upon what I understand about history, it seems like there was more authenticity to even, like, you know, the revolutionary forces back then, whereas today I don't think we really have a genuine civil society, in the sense that, you know, at the height of bourgeois liberalism, they had a civil society where there was actually, you know, obviously if you were kind of initiated into that sphere, I think there was genuine debate. There was genuine, a certain amount of genuine scientific exploration of, and philosophical exploration of the political as such. Whereas, you know, and I got at this when I recently did a live stream on the Think Tank book by Medvets, you know, just talking about the kind of rise of the think tank as this new institutional form in the United States in second half of the 20th century, how civil society itself, and I think this is partly due to technological advances as well, but civil society itself has kind of, it's become, you know, this kind of, you know, from a structural standpoint, it's become this social field that you, in order to compete within it, you need to get that right combination of resources and usefulness to politicians, and the kind of political process as such. And so you get this selection process that kind of conditions civil society with kind of rewards and punishments, like incentives, to basically fit into the status quo and reinforce the status quo under the illusion of being a civil society, a member of civil society that's not beholden to special interests, that's not beholden to power, that can kind of criticize power intellectually. But there really is no kind of free intellectual spaces in our society that at the same time are able to actually have influence like a free intellectual space would be the space that we're in right now, and that we perpetually exist in. But traversing from where we are to where influence is a mind-boggling proposition. That obviously that we have ambitions like that, but it's not exactly obvious how you do this, but it is quite obvious if you want to be a kind of status quo reinforcing intellectual, what positions you're allowed to hold and what institutions you need to kind of go through. It's a well-oiled machine. So I think this is interesting when thinking about the role of, because a lot of times people kind of undermine or minimize the role of civil society because they look at it and say, well, it's not, civil society is a kind of, as it's kind of presented within liberal ideology, that's not really how it is. Like, there isn't actually this kind of open discourse. Really, there's this network of NGOs and think tanks that are kind of fabricating a consensus that is kind of structurally reinforcing to power relations and a particular kind of managerial ideology that seemingly all the elite have, or at least are incentivized through this kind of like reciprocal social game that they're kind of engaged in to be elites, are incentivized to play along with. And whereas if you look at like China, for example, they also have a completely different model of civil society, but they also need to have a civil society because you, in order to be a modern state, you need to have a massive, comprehensive set of functions. You need to have experts. You need to have a bunch of historians. You need to have a bunch of economists. You need to have a bunch of sociologists and political scientists, etc. You need to have all these guys that are kind of working out, you know, the kind of agency of the state and various other institutions in society, how they're going to operate. And so you need to have this thing existing in your, you know, within the kind of fabric of your political culture in a kind of foundational way. But instead of China having this kind of copy paste version of what the West has, instead they have managed to be going in the opposite direction. So if anything, if you look at the trajectory of you know, the dominant ideological currents in China, they seem to be getting more conservative and more nationalist with every passing year. It seems like, where with us, it seems like it's going the opposite direction. So like, how is that actually possible for their civil society to be heading in the complete opposite direction to ours? There must be some kind of like structural elements that makes that possible. Obviously, there's a different kind of historical context as well, but, and I wouldn't want to minimize that completely, but, you know, I think that's something that we should probably be focusing on more in our circles is thinking more about kind of like from the perspective of design and structure, how a civil society functions to kind of drive. Because I mean, that was kind of the core of what Neo-Reaction was trying to get at with More Bugs Old Blog, right? With the whole cathedral concept, was he was basically describing quote unquote civil society as it really exists. He wasn't doing a very good job. He was trying to describe that. And I think, you know, I think that's a real social scientific challenge that we should be kind of living up to, not just looking at it in terms of like, well, here's the dialectical progression that produced progressivism. It's like, well, what's the kind of structural dynamics that produce this kind of civil society self-reinforcing in this clearly pathological direction?
Yeah, well, I mean, ultimately, it's the critique, right? The critique itself is what leads to this effectively recreating a civil war, but a civil war on the on the scale, basically a civil war between every man and every other man, where, you know, the most revealing part of the book, I think, is really where he talks about Rousseau. And he basically lays out the absolute incoherence of the notion of the general will as being, you know, every man beholden to every other man, and yet like one beholden to all and all beholden to one. The whole thing just doesn't make any sense at all. So you know, basically what civil society calls for under the thumb of absolutism is, you know, the conditions of freedom, basically, to allow them to think what they want, to allow them to, you know, for morality effectively to carve out a space that can't be penetrated into by politics. And this, of course, you know, flowers into critique. And, you know, the critical process for like all this truth seeking that the civil society is doing can only actually happen under conditions of freedom. So it's advocating for freedom. And this, in the Republic of Letters, everyone is, you know, everyone's like the master of all, and everyone is subject to the judgment of everybody else. And, you know, this is the perfect encapsulation, I think, of the connection between freedom and, I think, what you could call something like cultural Protestantism, where every man is a king, everyone is his own high priest, every man is supreme legislator for himself. And this is all brought on by critique, right? The very critique that was intended to act as a countervailing force for tyranny, which itself, in terms of absolutism, was brought on by the needs to end civil war. It effectively recreates this civil war in civil society. So, you know, the $64,000 question is, what is it that actually, what's the cause of that? You know, where does that actually come from? And it seems to be that the thesis of the book is implicitly that it's this separation of morality and politics that actually does that. It's the separation that that causes this issue, like this runaway civil war, of, you know, the crisis of critique that's, you know, the book is title is alluding to. But and at other points in the book, it almost seems like the separation is not the cause of critique or the criticism, but it's actually the effect of the criticism. So, you know, it's inherent in the concept of criticism that a separation of morality and politics takes place because of it. So if critique is just, you know, judging things or whatever, then critique is effectively, you know, testing different circumstances for their validity or its truth or its, you know, goodness or whatever. And then the idea is to arrive at a judgment, you know, based on this critique, based on the insights that you've won from your critical faculties. And this judgment basically extends to people, not just to ideas, right? So it seems here that the separation of morality and politics is as much a result of criticism as it is, or as much a cause of criticism as it's a result of criticism. So the critique must have come earlier. The critique is the problem, absolutely. But where does it come from? The separation is the effect of the critique. So where does it come from? And I think what you can see in this, and what makes this book ultimately very reactionary indeed, is it seems to be brought about, this critique seems to be brought about by the advent of conscience. It seems that as soon as you carve out a space for individual conscience to be a moral authority, that this critique is inevitable. So, you know, as I'm not sure that really gives us a whole lot to go on in terms of like how to reconstruct society, because clearly, you know, conscience is kind of at the basis of our society. Individual conscience is at the bottom of what our society is about, what it's been about for a long time. But it seems to me that critique follows almost a priori from that, from individual conscience. So, you know, to answer your question, what is it that creates a society that has this sort of like runaway permanent revolution? It seems that it comes from that. It comes from the license given to the individual person to be a moral authority.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what makes this problem like so challenging in the culture, though, which is, once you kind of compromise to try and circumnavigate one kind of vector of critique, then you kind of like it, then it's very difficult then to kind of restore like a sense of justice in authority, right? Because it's like, well, if as soon as the state exists on the basis of a compromise, then you know it's completely just abdicating, abdicating some kind of like fundamental, moral justification, at its core, and that is really an unsatisfactory state of affairs. State should be moral, right? It should be fundamentally a force for virtue in society. And you know, at times in history where, you know, if I think about like history of like in the Anglosphere, at times when politics was seemingly less destructive in our respective nations, was a time where I think people did have these attitudes. Like, I think if you asked a lot of people in the 1950s, for example, what are your attitudes toward government? They have done studies on this. You know, the overwhelming majority of people had positive attitudes towards government and trust in elite institutions at that time. Not like everything was perfect, but there was just this sense that there was the majority of people who made up these positions of power were, you know, at a fundamental level virtuous and well-intentioned. I think almost no one thinks that today. And so, you know, that's the thing. It's not like it's impossible, I think, for like certain critiques to be satisfied to kind of, I think, so like to say, like, I don't think all critiques are equivalent. I think you can have good criticisms, like ones that are actually, you know, actionable, ones that can actually be solved, that seem elementary, that have like a kind of elementary kind of reasonableness to them. Because you can say, well, look, if we're going to have a society, we need to have XYZ basic elements. And then I think some critiques are just ridiculous. Like, you know, a lot of what I think, you know, a lot of this kind of conservative, anti-leftist, like intellectually lazy commentary, the reason why it can be so popular is because a lot of the kind of fundamental imperatives that are kind of demanded by, you know, far leftists, let's say, are just so obviously ridiculous. Like, they're just so obviously disconnected from anything realistic, that, you know, it's like, if you can just be a normal person and like look down your nose at these people, like, ugh, haha, like what kind of morons are you people? Like, you guys are insane. It's just like kind of almost like just obvious if you aren't like a kind of a mentally ill nutcase that these are like, you know, the whole like trans thing or whatever is just ridiculous. Whereas, so I think, like, you know, there are certain elements of critique then, like critiquing the current order, I think is quite valid. But then, you know, there are times in history where things have actually been pretty good and people still want to criticize. So, like, for bringing up the example of China, it's like, well, you know, the kind of West portrays, okay, well, the Chinese, like, they have no freedom, you know, the party has like authoritarian control. You know, there's all these like limits on speech and so forth. You know, you can turn around and look at the United States and say, well, it's not really that different. There's a veneer of freedom in the United States that doesn't exist in China, but there's still a lot of these elements of social control just in different forms. But even putting that to one side, at least, you know, when they poll Chinese people and say, do you think the country's heading in the right direction? 95% of them say yes. You know, when you look at like where China was 4 decades ago to today, you know, the whole country, majority of them were in poverty. And now, you know, that's been like eradicated for like hundreds of millions of people. They actually went from being peasants that, you know, have 2 bowls of rice a day to eat and, you know, living in squalor to having a car and a house and like, you know, living in a kind of modernized society where their kids get to go to school and stuff like this, get it, you know, university even potentially. And it's like, it's pretty obvious if you're, you know, probably like a middle-aged Chinese person that, well, the people that are running my country are making it better. Like how it was when I was a kid, it's way better now. Whereas I think when you talk to, I mean, you would know this better than me, Mike, you know, when you talk to people that are, you know, when I talk to people that are a bit older and I ask them about how things used to be, their eyes light up with nostalgia. Like it was way better back in the 90s or the 80s or whenever than it was today. Shout out to Morgoth. Like Morgoth is always going on about how great the 90s were. You know what I mean? And most old people feel that way. Like old from my perspective, sorry. And even I feel like that to an extent, that like things were way better when I was, you know, back in the, you know, like, you know, back in the 2010s or whatever. It was like back when, you know, things were more sane or whatever, you know. So that kind of pervasive feeling in your society is like, well, maybe you should be criticizing the people that are in charge. If you feel like, and everyone has this pervasive feeling that things are getting worse, maybe you should. But on the flip side, if you're living in a place where things are kind of getting better, maybe you should shut up and pipe down. You know what I mean? And I think that a lot of the critique that was happening in, like, particularly if you look at like the Cultural Revolution, the Sexual Revolution, and you know, in the 1960s in the West, you know, the kind of whole hippie movement, the counterculture, was that a critique? That was, I mean, I guess you had the anti-war movement that I can understand why people didn't want to be conscripted to go fight wars in Vietnam or whatever. But outside of this, did a lot of these people really have legitimate things that they were bringing up? I don't think so. I think it was like basically like luxury whining mixed with like existential crisis and too many drugs. So it's like, do these people have a legitimate reason to critique? No, they needed to pipe down. They had it like literally better than ever. Like it literally didn't get better than that in human history for a generation. And they wanted to rip it all up and like undermine the foundations. Yeah. So I think, you know, I think we can actually have like a reasonable way of talking about these things. And it's like, it's kind of like you have to play the game, but ultimately it's like, I think you have to kind of set a realistic standard that can actually be met by virtuous authorities, not like a strong society could actually be built around. And I think that's really the problem with the direction of revolutionary critique, many kind of strands of it in the West, is that it's either gone like you either have that kind of like mental communist strand, or this kind of anarchistic liberal strand or whatever, that this this radical emancipation nonsense that ultimately is just destructive rather than constructive. You know, when you, like, I've even heard like certain like elements of the communist movement, maybe the more like reasonable elements, if you could say so, that will talk about, you know, the so-called Western Marxists, all they care about is like, you know, throwing bricks at police cars and you know, LARPing about revolution. But then you bring up like the Communist Party of China and they say, well, that's not real communism. And it's like, okay, but they're actually, you know, they're actually lifting people out of poverty and like actually materially benefiting their people. What are you doing? You're just posting on Reddit and being antisocial. You know, like you're not actually doing anything. So, yeah, I mean,
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of brought it down to earth a little bit with that, but I don't know if that really satisfies you, or if you feel like we need to take, you need to take a more radical philosophical position on the question of critique.
Well, it's, I mean, this is kind of really the cardinal problem. Once the genie is let out of the bottle, once the critique, you know, Pandora's box gets open, all the shit flies out, and your society within a few generations or a century or two is hollowing its own self out, you know, by its moral, you know, just by its moral pretensions, right? And, you know, there is something, I mean, obviously, like in the 60s, there were things that needed to be critiqued. But the people who were sort of, who had the megaphones that were doing the critiquing at that point were not the right ones. They were the ones who needed to shut the fuck up and just be happy with the unprecedented high point at which, you know, at least materially, that Western civilization had attained to, and probably won't again for 1,000 years, but like, they're still not happy with the material conditions, right? And, you know, fast forward to today, and critiquing the order is absolutely valid, especially coming from the perspective that we're coming from. Certainly, I mean, there's still critiques, a massive amount of critiques platform today from the left, basically saying like, look, you know, it's not egalitarian enough, it's not whatever enough, it's not progressive enough, and all of this. But there obviously are definite reasons why the society deserves critique. I mean, you know, like you say, talking to the older generation, like I remember talking to my dad back when when Trump was running the first time, and asking him, have you ever seen anything like this before? Have you ever seen people hating each other? Have you ever seen this degree of polarization? And he was like, no, not at all. This is totally different, you know? And when you're in the thick of it, I mean, you know, the first and second Obama elections, those seem pretty contentious. You know, if anybody who remembers the Bush years, there was a lot of like nasty political stuff that was going on at that point, but it just, it was so much worse, you know, when Trump came along, because of the polarization, because of the situation that our society was in at that point. So critique coming from our side is absolutely valid. It needs to be leveled. And we would be remiss if we didn't critique our society. But the question then is, how do you call a halt to that? When you either have won, or like, because obviously will never be a final victory, utopia or whatever. But how does you wind that back? How does critique ever, you know, get dialed back? Much less dialed back. How do you stop it from accelerating the way that it basically has continuously since the French Revolution? And it's a terrifying thought that maybe critique or reason actually is corrosive, and it's inherently corrosive, because of course we want, you know, our critical faculties are what allow us to know the truth. It's what allows us to, you know, produce moral judgments, and, you know, to improve ourselves in all ways, morally and materially and socially and in all these different ways. Reason helps us with that. But at the same time, it almost seems like there is a corrosive aspect to it as well. Like the term critique goes back to the Renaissance humanists, the actual term itself, but it's much older as a concept than it is as a term. It's, you know, certainly there have been critics for more than 500 years. But in this sense of critique, you know, basically what it meant at that point, what it meant to the Renaissance humanists was the objective evaluation of a text, right? So you could be a critic, but you could also be a Christian at this time, right? And those two were not antithetical to each other. But invariably, whatever the object of criticism is, even in the sense of like objectively trying to get to the bottom of like, what is it that the, you know, what is it that the actual text of the Septuagint says, whatever the object of criticism, the object becomes demythologized and undermined. And I think that this is the terrifying part of Kosalek's thesis. He gives the example of this guy named Capel, whose method of criticism, you know, criticism in the sense of like objectively evaluating a text, it eroded the principle of belief in scripture. And this was pointed out by others later on. So basically what criticism does, you know, when even in this benign sense of trying to get to the bottom of the truth of like what it of, you know, let's just say scripture or whatever, it draws a line between reason and say tradition, because of course your reason is the sort of independent faculty that allows you to evaluate this text. And why would you be evaluating the text unless you thought that the tradition didn't have it right in the first place? So the criticism draws this line between reason and tradition, which in, you know, in the context of, you know, the Quattrocento would have been like the Catholic magisterium. So there's a line between those two. And then as time, you know, things proceed and we get closer to the Reformation, this criticism starts to draw a line even between reason and scripture itself, between reason and revelation, you know, that is sola scriptura, where the individual becomes the sole arbiter of what it is that is meant by scripture, right? So basically at all stages, even at the most benign and even like good stage at the beginning, you get this line between private conscience and the public expression of religious authority. And later this line between private conscience and public expression gets transmuted into the schism between morality or private conscience and politics or public law. And then we've arrived at the position, you know, the stage at which the book opens. I mean, the schism comes earlier, but that's the point is that it seems to be just critique as such, or we could even say reason, that starts this process. And it's not clear how to get out of this dialectic or get out of this dynamic, because, I mean, what are we going to do? Are we going to just like not be rational? Are we just going to like, you know, drop reason entirely? It obviously that you can't do that. But it seems to have this effect. So it's a real conundrum. And I mean, kudos to Kosalek for putting his finger on the problem. Even though he doesn't really sort of phrase it in this way, but it seems latent in the text that you get this problem here. So it's a very interesting book and worth reading for that alone, I think.
Yeah, I mean, On the subject of critique, like, I think it sounds kind of trite maybe, but it really does, I think, come down to kind of constructive versus destructive criticism. Like a lot of this, when discussing Freemasonry, a lot of it is kind of paranoia about the state, and this idea, and obviously this kind of reproduced again and again in like the various iterations of liberalism. That's one thing that they have kind of common. Despite the kind of so many other elements of the ideology that has mutated over centuries, really, it's this kind of paranoia about state power. And, you know, obviously the state can do bad things, but I feel as though this is really the wrong attitude to be taking towards the state. Instead, the attitude that should be taken towards the state is, well, what should the state be doing? Like, what are the state's proper roles, and like how can it do those properly, as opposed to how can we limit what the state is doing? How can we break it down? How can we undermine it and create institutions outside of it that can undercut it? and check it and so forth. And I really do think that that is kind of the essence of the problem, because once you, I mean, there's two kind of issues. Like one issue is that, well, once you attack the state, then the state will kind of counterattack to defend itself. And that's not necessarily going to be the best possible state, one that has to survive in that scenario. But also secondarily, you know, you're not really kind of treating the state as a vehicle for, you know, what its fundamental virtue is, which is supposed to be, like in my view, on the basis of popular sovereignty, it's supposed to be essentially, you know, ruling the people and serving the people, and serving the nation. And so by kind of attacking the state in a way indirectly, you're really kind of attacking like the unity of a people, the unity of a nation, a kind of collective identity, that kind of focal point of patriotism. And I think that that is incredibly destructive, because once you start kind of taking shots at like the unity of your people, you're attacking something that is so dangerous to attack, something that should be sacred, that should be preserved from critique in many respects. So, yeah, you should be not critiquing and undermining that, but you should be kind of maybe criticizing the state on behalf of the nation, saying, well, you're not really kind of doing what you should be doing, and this is what you should be doing in order to really make the nation strong and you know, protect it and enable it to prosper. So I think it really, I mean, obviously I have my particular kind of beliefs, and so obviously I think that they're correct, but I think ultimately I kind of view my criticisms as, you know, in the main kind of constructive. So I don't think there's really any way out of it. Like if you don't want to accept the current order, and even paradoxically, if you do want to accept the current order, you have to kind of accept the validity of that kind of discourse. And then if you don't want to accept it, well, then you need to criticize it. And so you got no choice but to kind of play this discursive game. Like there's no way you can put, you know, Western civilization back in the box and go back to some like primitive conditions where you can where you're kind of like just born into a tradition that you can kind of just organically accept and live within. And you could view that as a tragedy, I think, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. I don't think that the project of you know, basically like rationally defending a kind of virtuous worldview is a project that is impossible to carry out. It's just a difficult project, I guess. And there's a lot of places, there's a lot of tripwires and cul-de-sacs and places where you can get tripped up along the way. But I think it's the only way out, in my view, is to try and get it right.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I mean, like, you know, there's no way to do away with critique. But I think that it's at the same time that we have to admit that there are some things into which critique should not be allowed to penetrate. It's not a free-for-all. Looking at the foundation of your civilization is something that was at one point considered kind of dangerous. You know, like you think of the analogy of, even though it's not an analogy, but analogously you could compare it to the idea of looking at the face of God. Which is something that is, I mean, you're just asking for trouble there, right? And I think it even, you can even justify rationally the idea that there are some things into which critique should not be allowed to penetrate, like, you know, looking at, into, I mean, trying to demystify the mysterium of the church or something like that. That would be an example of that. And many people have justified rationally the idea that critique should be limited and that not everything is kind of up for grabs. But apart from that, you know, a possible solution that is a little bit more practical, perhaps, to the like runaway critique situation that we find ourselves in, is to just simply ask, what would a healthy state look like? It's one thing to critique the state as it is and to say, look, it doesn't measure up, it's not doing its job and all of that. But it's another thing to point to an example or to, you know, to imagine something that would be healthy, and especially point to the example, like you mentioned China, for example. This is a very powerful thing, I think, is just pointing to a state that's actually working and seeing and just saying, like, look, that's obviously a good thing. We don't have it. And that, you know, this is it is a critique, you know, because you're obviously comparing your own civilization to another one. But at the same time, it's something kind of positive, right? And even if it's a matter of trying to imagine something that doesn't exist that would be in a healthy state, it's just the conjuring of the healthy view, just the conjuring up of the idea has a way of kind of calling it into being. But again, Kosela kind of anticipates this, because in his book, like, you know, in his thesis, is that this is this conjuring of the view of what a moral life looks like, even though it's maybe a completely apolitical philosophy, is exactly how private morality becomes a political force, even if private morality is purely apolitical. And then we're kind of back to the charges that have been leveled against this book of it being like too pessimistic, too cynical toward the foundations of the modern world, or too cynical towards the Enlightenment. And I guess there's something to those charges, right? Because it doesn't really give you much of a way out or much hope that this crisis can be resolved. So maybe it is pessimistic, but at the same time, it's also truthful. I think that there's something to this. Ultimately, it doesn't give us a way out, and it's not clear what the way out would be. It's not clear that we'll be able to think our way out of the situation. Maybe it's a matter of divine will. Maybe it's the will of God or fate or whatever is going to be the thing that moves the dial, which is a terrifying thing to think about. But it just seems within the framework of this crisis of critique that critique itself can't resolve the crisis, because critique gave rise to the crisis. It's a bit of a black pill, I'll be honest, but there it is. It's very much worth reading anyway.
But I think it's also the specific dynamic that he's identifying here, which is this kind of bifurcation, this dualism, political dualism of society and the state. And I guess this is really the fundamental problem that is, you know, all the kind of modernist political ideologies are trying to kind of solve. Obviously, you know, as a nationalist, I do believe that that's kind of how you solve it, right? That a kind of a strong identification of society defined as the ethnos with the state is really kind of the solution here. But yeah, that's obviously, you know, what gave rise to socialism and various other ideologies as well. So, you know, that's overcoming that dualism, I guess, is really kind of, I think, what's wrong here. And that, and the kind of critique, the crisis of legitimacy is just the inability for society and the state to be reconciled to one another. And I think a lot of that is to do with a ridiculous concept of what society is, you know, because of this emancipatory project that is kind of being engaged in with liberalism, which is, and to a certain extent, communism, which is a project that is antisocial, I think, in an elementary sense, just by virtue of the fact that the state isn't imposing social conditions which are oppressing you entirely according to these ideologies, generally speaking. Society as such is the problem. So they're going to be attacking the family. They're going to be attacking faith. They're going to be attacking national differences. And yeah, you know, the kind of like the tendency towards post-national, you know, post-racial, secular, post-ethnic society. This is something that is really not society anymore. It's a kind of caricature of society. It's really all it is just economy. It's not really society at this point. So I think an actual kind of like, you know, rigorous theory of what a community is fundamentally, like what a nation is fundamentally, has to be the kind of way out. And I think if you define things correctly in those terms and critique on those terms, that it is around this unit, this organic, more organic and legitimate unit of community and of society around which political institutions should be built, and therefore the state will have legitimacy, and we can overcome this kind of crisis of incompatibility and kind of a dualism between state and society. I think only this is really the way out of this crisis. It isn't so much just critique in the abstract, I don't think, but critique within this kind of dualism that makes up political modernism.
Yeah, well, as far as answering the question of what is it that, you know, what is a nation? What is our nation? Who are we as a people? As far as that is concerned, I mean, that is a question that does need to be arbitrated, you know, with critique. And I think that the one of the sort of weaknesses of the book is that it sort of short sells the idea of a historical identity, in that it's a kind of qualified, because basically he's really got a problem with the philosophy of history, and it seems, again, a lot of the text is like, a lot of the critiques are kind of implicit in the text. It seems like he implicitly has a problem with historicism itself, and to the degree that, you know, in terms of what he's talking about, what he means by philosophy of history, yes, it's something not good. When he says basically that philosophy of history is subversive, what he means effectively is that the Enlightenment, and especially these secret societies, historicized the social order by basically retconning history, like the Masonic history of the society was not true. It was not the real history, right? It was basically something invented to make itself the telos of history, right? The end and fulfillment of history. And by doing this, these, you know, by inaugurating this this philosophy of history, these societies and the other elements of the society effectively did away with the need for revolution. The state would collapse of itself, you know, for lacking faith in its own mission and its own authority. This is not something good, okay? Like, I would never dispute that. But the idea of historicism itself, taking ourselves to be a concrete and organic historical phenomenon as a nation, you know, take, for example, the English nation and its diaspora. Taking that to be a historical phenomenon is, I think, one possible way out of this. It's, or at the very least, it's the best option, where, you know, I've been quite critical recently in like some of my Substack posts and some of my appearances on other podcasts of what I'm calling the idea of propositional identity. That identity is, the identity of the English is, you know, we believe in the free market and we believe in egalitarianism and we believe in liberalism. Like basically what England or, you know, let's just say the West as a broader, restrict it to England so it's a nation. What the nation is about fundamentally is it's about that we all believe this, that, and the other thing, which effectively precludes any notion that there could be an ethnic identity, that there could be a shared historical identity, that there could be a cultic or religiously practical identity, that we all go to the same church or whatever. All these things are kind of precluded by the idea of propositional identity, where what we are fundamentally is a shared belief. At best, what the propositional identity does is it subordinates these other things, where these other things are really actually the fundamental core of what the nation is and should be. So I think that one of the dangers in this book is to sort of denigrate historicism and the notion of the people or a nation as a historical entity. There's a kind of a weird movement, or there's a kind of a weird intellectual current sort of running through the dissident right these days of anti-historicism. And I don't think this is a good thing. I think that historicism and the conceptualization of the nation as a historical phenomenon is probably one of the best ways out of this critical crisis that we seem to have entered into. So, I mean, you know, this is not to say that we should just give up and, you know, we're stuck in this, you know, this dialectic or dynamic that will never end or whatever. You know, there are things that can be done. And I think that that's probably one of them.
Yeah, so I think maybe we can kind of start bringing this to a close because we've been going for a while. But yeah, I think we got some interesting thoughts out of this text. But yeah, I don't really think that there's, you know, it is a lot of fluff, I will say that, for ultimately what you get. And a lot of what it's saying was kind of things that I'd already thought based upon, I mean, in many ways, it is just kind of like a summary of certain ideas in Hobbes and this kind of like, how do you get from Hobbes to Rousseau? Is kind of like the story in a way. And having read Hobbes and Rousseau, some of that was quite intuitive to connect anyway. So, but yeah, it is important to kind of, Hobbes and Rousseau are both important thinkers, so it's an important text. And Kosellek is an interesting, he has like interesting, like little, you know, paragraphs and phrases. Like he has a, you can tell like he is a interesting thinker, the way that he approaches certain things. And I'm interested very much in reading some of his other work. I know Nigel Carlsbad has written about him on his blog. So wouldn't mind exploring conceptual history more going forward in some capacity. But did you have any other final thoughts, Mike, before we kind of close this off?
I mean, just to summarize my take on it, it's the book is said to be something quite reactionary. Liberals hate it, whatever. And I think that they're right to hate it, but they should hate it even more because, although, you know, I mean, the writing style and it's too repetitive and everything, putting all of that aside, I think he's actually getting at something here. That the separation, the schism between morality and politics does give rise to this dynamic that is just completely hollows out your society. But the issue is that his historical starting point is way too late and seems kind of arbitrary, and that this has been going on for much longer. than what he explains. So I think that the text is actually incredibly reactionary, more so even than it's said to be. So, you know, it gets a thumbs up for me for that. So very interesting, worth reading. Wish it was shorter, but it's still worthwhile.
I think that would be a good place to end it, like that you're kind of summing up.
Cool. Yeah, that's good. I'll just end here.